Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Pitordi of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who assesses the final report of the commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks. Wayne Smith, senior fellow with the Center for International Policy in Washington, who analyzes recent changes in the Bush administration's policy towards Cuba. And John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who assesses the platform and strategy of the Democrats as party delegates gathered in Boston to nominate John Kerry for president. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a renewed push for unilateralism, the Republican-run House of Representatives has passed a bill banning economic aid to nations that do not sign an agreement exempting U.S. personnel from the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, or ICC. The so-called Nethercutt Amendment, named after its sponsor, Congressman George Nethercutt of Washington State, was passed 241-166 in early July, even though Congressman Jim Colby, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, opposed it. According to the website OneWorld.net, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay used the debate to bash the United Nations and described the International Criminal Court, designed to prosecute war crimes, as UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's kangaroo court. The treaty creating the ICC was ratified by 100 nations, including Canada and all of the NATO bloc except Turkey. In June, the Bush administration was forced to drop its plan to seek renewal of a UN resolution that exempted from prosecution by the court US soldiers serving as peacekeepers. Human rights groups are strongly opposed to the anti-ICC amendment. As Don Kraus of Citizens for Global Solutions said, "The Nethercutt Amendment targets democracies that uphold the rule of law and work alongside the US to further our foreign policy priorities." With less than 100 days to go before the hotly contested presidential election, the American Civil Liberties Union is going to trial in Ohio in an attempt to throw out that state's punch card voting machines, similar to those that were at the center of the 2000 Florida recount debacle. The ACLU, which has filed similar suits in Maryland, Illinois, and Georgia, wants the machines removed before the November election, saying that reliance on punch card machines leads to errors and an undercount of minority votes. According to the Associated Press, nearly 75% of Ohio voters use punch card ballots. The state of Ohio has pledged to phase out the punch card machines, but problems with electronic voting machines have delayed the elimination of the existing punch card system. In 2000, Bush won Ohio, but the loss of thousands of manufacturing jobs during the current downturn has made Ohio a battleground state. A July poll shows that the race between George W. Bush and John Kerry is a dead heat. Voting technology consultant Michael Shamos, who blasts the use of punch card machines, thinks the ACLU will have a difficult time making its case of racial discrimination. Last Thanksgiving weekend, two federal airport security trainers, Ray Guagliardi and Tom Bittler, noticed many security lapses at the Buffalo-Niagara International Airport. They saw airport screeners fail to check baggage for weapons and explosives as mandated by federal law. When alarm bells did sound, the screeners only made token inspections. The two trainers, who work for the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, complained to their supervisor, who ignored them. Afterwards, they sent a letter to TSA headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. 2 months later, their jobs were eliminated. According to Mother Jones magazine, the duo has now filed for whistleblower protection status, joining 43 other former TSA workers who claim they were wrongly terminated. Lax airport security appears to be a problem across the country. Recent confidential tests showed that scanners missed 20% of the prohibited items like concealed guns, knives, and simulated bombs that were brought through by testers. Since the 9/11 terror attacks, the federal government has spent $11 billion on establishing the new TSA and the purchase of modern detection equipment. Yet, since the early days of the TSA, the nation's big airline companies have pushed for quick inspections, leading the first TSA director, John McGaugh, to quit after only 6 months on the job. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
The bipartisan commission, appointed to investigate the September 11th terrorist attacks, released their final 567-page report on July 22nd. The commission examined the activities of the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, the flaws in U.S. intelligence operations prior to the attacks, the performance of the Bush and Clinton administrations, and rescue efforts on 9/11. The commission made several recommendations for the reorganization of the nation's 15 intelligence agencies, including the appointment of a cabinet-level national intelligence director. The report also examined the Bush administration's planning for the Iraq War and found there was no connection between Saddam Hussein's government and the terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington. President Bush, who initially resisted the establishment of the 9/11 Commission, now says he is considering the panel's recommendations. One of the organizations closely following the proceedings of the commission was September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, founded by family members of those killed on 9/11 who have united to turn their grief into action for peace. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Petorti, co-director of the group whose brother died at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Petorti assesses the commission's report and expresses solidarity with victims of terrorism, violence, and war from around the world.
You know, commissions in general are created to pretty much whitewash the real story. But having said that, I would say I'm glad that there's a commission report. I would make the point that this report would not exist without the work of a handful of widows. They call them the Jersey Girls or the Family Steering Committee. And it is important to look at the recommendations and to read the narrative of all of the failures. But I think if you don't deal with the why of terrorism, if you don't really deal with why people want to kill us, and you just sort of look at all the failures without any sort of self-reflection, that we're never going to be safe. But in just glancing through the report, I wrote down a couple of notes, and on page 363, they do make a really good statement. They say the long-term success demands the use of all elements of national power: diplomacy, intelligence, covert action, law enforcement, economic policy, foreign aid, public diplomacy, and homeland defense. And that is exactly the stuff we were saying in November of 2001, that it's good to be a strong nation, you need a strong defense, but you've got to use all of the fingers on your hand. You know, you've got to use all of your tools. So I really like that paragraph. A couple other notes I made at various parts. Page 362, they're talking about this stream of Islamic fundamentalism that does not distinguish politics from religion, thus distorting both. And then on page 372, they talk about the Western notion of the separation of civic and religious duty does not exist in Islamic cultures. And I couldn't help but thinking about what President Bush is doing to politics and religion, and how he is bringing them together so overtly and thus distorting both, just as the commissioner said. And then a little bit later on, page 376, they talk about the U.S. government. It should offer an example of moral leadership in the world, committed to treat people humanely and abide by the rule of law and be generous and caring to our neighbors, and that we should stress life over death and widespread political participation and contempt for indiscriminate violence. And it includes the respect for the rule of law, openness in discussing differences, tolerance for opposing points of view. And these are all wonderful things. Unfortunately, we're not doing any of them in Iraq, and we're not doing any of them in Afghanistan. You know, if this is the recommendation of the 9/11 Commission and President Bush says he wants to enact it, well, great. Why don't we start with that stuff? They do acknowledge that America's foreign policy choices have consequences, and that's a really good statement. And they go on to say in the 9/11 report, right or wrong, it is simply a fact that American policy regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and American actions in Iraq are dominant staples of popular commentary across the Arab and Muslim world. But then they go on and they say, but that does not mean that U.S. choices have been wrong, however. So, you know, they're sort of on the right track there, but they're just not willing to acknowledge that we might be doing something wrong. And I think if you're going to have any sort of self-reflection, that among the possibilities has to be the fact that, yeah, maybe we just screwed up and we're wrong. And I guess, you know, maybe that's just not the place. You know, maybe an official government document is not the place where you're going to hear that. But we had, you know, some concerns about how the thing was put together. We thought that people were a little too collegial with each other. We had some concerns about the vetting process in the report. How exactly Was the report put together? Who exactly looked at it? Was it just President Bush who was deciding what was in it? What wasn't in it? And we certainly had that problem with Philip Zelikow being the executive director of the commission because he's, you know, very, very close with Condoleezza Rice, and they wrote a book together, a couple books together, I think. So we have seen that as a real conflict of interest and just do not understand why he was on the commission, you know, essentially editing the whole thing, and it certainly doesn't seem like it did a lot of good in terms of candor.
David Pitorti, having lost your older brother at the World Trade Center and discussions with other family members, what is it you'd like to see happen in terms of government action as a result of the September 11th attacks? If this report certainly doesn't satisfy what you think should occur now, what would?
I think we just have to get out of Iraq. And I know that, you know, there's this certainly a lot of people who say, well, look, we went in and, you know, we broke it and now we've got to fix it. But I think so much of our problems just come from us, specifically us being in Iraq. And I guess I fall down on the side of first, we've just got to get out of there so that people stop killing our troops and stop using us as a target. And the second half of the equation is we've got to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the central argument against the United States in the Arab world. You know, I know that that's not specific to 9/11, but I think 9/11 really did come out of those two things. I think it really is all about foreign policy, how we relate to the world. People don't just hate us. They hate us because of what we do to them. And, you know, as Howard Zinn said the other night, if we just stop bothering people, they will stop bothering us. I know that's an incredible oversimplification, but the fact is we bother a lot of people in the world, and that's why they don't like us. You know, we're a wonderful country, but we do some really horrible things, so we should stress the wonderful things and try to fix the bad things.
That was David Pitorti, co-director of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. The group is conducting a march commemorating civilian war dead from Boston, the site of the Democratic National Convention, to New York City, where the GOP will hold its presidential convention at the end of August. For more information about the march, call area code 212-598-0970. Or visit the group's website at www.peacefultomorrows.org. On May 6th, President Bush announced a series of strict new measures his administration will impose against Cuba. These included restrictions severely limiting visits to Cuba by family members living in the U.S. to only once every 3 years, compared to the previous once-a-year limitation. The range of relatives to whom money can be sent has also been narrowed. In addition, the White House is considering a proposal for the use of military aircraft to transmit radio and television programming to Cuba from international airspace, a violation of the International Communications Convention. U.S. Representative Lincoln Diaz-Balart, Republican of Florida, is one of the Cuban exiles in Congress offering cues to the White House. He is urging that the U.S. once again consider assassinating Cuban President Fidel Castro. Other Florida politicians are calling for the use of military force against Castro's government. Shortly after Mr. Bush announced his Cuba sanctions, more than 1 million people in Havana demonstrated against the policies. Wayne Smith is a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy in Washington and former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana under the Carter administration. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the new Cuba measures and compares them with the Bush administration's controversial policies toward Iraq.
If Mr. Bush is trying to court votes in Miami, that he's causing this suffering among the Cuban Americans. Of course, the answer to that is that he only listens to a small, hardline core of exiles down there. He doesn't listen to the others, and I think that's a miscalculation on his part, and it may result in his losing Florida. But in any event, as you look at the measures against Cuban Americans traveling, practically cutting off academic exchanges between Cuba and the United States, and again, that's not going to bring the Castro regime down. Students don't spend much money in Cuba when they go, and I might add, neither do their professors. So where are the measures that will bring an end, as they say, to the Castro government? There aren't any. So the Cubans are concluding there must be more to it than that. As they put it, the real stuff, the military, actions against Cuba that would follow the elections if George Bush wins. I personally have my doubts that even the Bush administration would be so foolish as to take military action against Cuba. There would be an outcry in the world, and what would be accomplished?
Can you talk a little bit about the head of Commando 4, who was on public TV in Miami, actually asking for donations for an invasion? And there's also been a request by Diaz-Balart to fund the assassination of Fidel Castro.
Well, not so much to fund, but Diaz-Balart has urged the assassination of Fidel Castro, saying it would be a humanitarian act, saving the Cuban people great pain and suffering.
Well, it's quite a statement from a congressional representative.
Exactly, yeah, but he keeps calling for the assassination of Castro and all sorts of other things that I think should be an embarrassment to the U.S. Congress.
Can you compare the new Bush policy to his policy in Iraq?
You know, there are a lot of similarities. For one thing, it's clear he came to office already with the idea of invading Iraq. It was sort of an obsession with him. The same thing with Cuba. He came into office with the idea of confrontation and very quickly moved to this idea of regime change. Secondly, in Iraq, we listened to a little group of exiles who assured us we'd be welcomed as liberators, that Iraqi oil money would pay for the occupation and the reconstruction. Well, we listened to them, and it turned out that they had no idea what they were talking about. They were totally out of contact with Iraqi reality because they'd been living abroad for years and years. The same thing here. President Bush is listening to a little group of hardline exiles down in Miami who are assuring him this is the way to go, just a little more pressure and Castro's going to collapse. Well, that's what they've been saying for more than 40 years now, and it's not going to work any better this time than it did then. And, of course, then third, in Iraq, we defied the United Nations. In we went, in defiance of international conventions, international law, and the U.N. Security Council. In Cuba, in calling for the end of the Castro regime, that we are going to put an end to the Castro regime, we're acting in open defiance of the OAS Charter, which forbids intervention in the internal affairs of another country. But, again, the Bush administration doesn't give a fig about international law, international conventions, or even international cooperation.
A letter has been sent to President Bush from many people, bipartisan group of prominent business leaders, ex-government officials, even elected officials and humanitarian leaders from across the nation. And it was sent by the Americans for Humanitarian Trade with Cuba, the AHTC. People like David Rockefeller have signed this, Paul Volcker, former chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, General Jack Sheehan, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, and I believe under President Nixon. What is your opinion of this? What they're asking for is a resumption of trade regarding food,
sure,
medicine, and travel.
As long as the United States is threatening Cuba, trying to choke it economically, the Cuban government will react defensively, of course, and demand internal discipline. Everyone rally around the flag against the threat from the North. So the best thing we could do is reduce tensions, begin a dialogue, begin engagement, and I think then of its own course, quite normally, the Cubans will begin to relax, engage with us, and begin to make some positive change, move in the direction of a more thoroughly mixed economy and a more, let's say, open society. Cuba seems to have the same effect on American administrations that the full moon once had on werewolves. And that was 22 years ago. Nothing has changed. If anything, the Bush administration is the worst ever. They are counterproductive. They accomplish nothing. They suggest that no one in the Bush administration can think.
That was Wayne Smith, senior fellow with the Center for International Policy in Washington and former chief of the U.S. Intersection in Havana. Contact the center at area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. As thousands of Democratic Party delegates converged on Boston for their nominating convention, police put in place an extraordinary array of security measures across the city, including the closure of an interstate highway. Around the Fleet Center convention site, protesters were restricted to a so-called free speech zone that a federal judge likened to an internment camp. As has been the trend with both major political parties in recent years, these conventions are highly scripted events with tight restrictions even applied to messages written on placards held by delegates. With the predictability and lack of dramatic news stories at today's conventions, broadcast television is devoting decreasing amounts of coverage. This year, the major networks will only air 1 hour of coverage on 3 of the 4 nights of both conventions. While Democrats appear to be united in the campaign to defeat President Bush in November, the delegates who are gathered in Boston to nominate John Kerry as their candidate for the White House differ with the Massachusetts senator on some key issues. An overwhelming number of delegates oppose the Iraq invasion from the beginning, unlike Mr. Kerry, who voted to give Mr. Bush the authority to launch the war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who assesses the platform and strategy of the Democrats as they prepare for what many describe as the most important election in their lifetime.
So I think the Democratic platform is a more left-wing document than it was in 92, 96, or 2000. John Kerry is a significantly more liberal figure than Bill Clinton or Al Gore. Certainly on social issues and also on some of the structural and regulatory issues. And so the platform for the first time ever contains, or certainly the first time in modern history, contains a decent media reform component. There's actually a section that endorses localism, diversity, a lot of the buzzwords of the media reform movement. That was inserted mainly at the demand of some of the unions, particularly Communication Workers of America. There's also, and I think this is significant, the Democratic platform drops all references to the death penalty. Clinton and Gore both supported the death penalty. Kerry is an opponent of the death penalty. Finally, the platform has some reasonably good, not great, but reasonably good language on trade policy, much, much better than you had in 92, 96, or 2000. And that is because, unlike Clinton and Gore, Kerry has at least accepted some of the fair trade mantra of labor and progressive groups. So there has been some movement, but it's not a dramatic movement. And this is the important thing. I'm not sure the Democrats are going to really run on these shifts. I mean, I doubt John Kerry is going to go out there and say, you know, I'm opposed to the death penalty. I don't think he'll ever utter those words. They may actually do some running on the trade issues in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, where free trade in the Bush model certainly is unpopular. So, you know, you'll see bits and pieces of it, but it would be completely unrealistic to think that John Kerry is going to run a radical campaign for the presidency or even a particularly entertaining campaign for the presidency. I think it will be a relatively cautious, mainstream Democratic campaign that will rely heavily on the message that George Bush is scary.
One of the elements in the Democratic Party that has consistently worked for and has been successful in moving the Democrats to the right has been the Democratic Leadership Council, of which both Al Gore and Bill Clinton were leaders of. Tell us a little bit about the DLC and the influence they're having on this convention and the policies that John Kerry is adopting.
Well, the Democratic Leadership Council, which is better referred to as Democrats for the Leisure Class, or Democrats Leaning Corporate, is a horrible and indefensible grouping. They are really just a conduit for corporate money, and what they do is they collect money from all the big companies that want to influence politics and, frankly, you know, buy off a bunch of your more weaselly Democrats who like to run around and say that they're good for business. And frankly, they're exceptionally damaging to the Democratic Party because Democrats draw people to the polls and get voters excited by promising to tax the rich, by promising to, you know, crack down on Benedict Arnold corporations, by really, you know, standing for something. When the DLC came into prominence in around the early 90s, Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. They held the majority of governorships. They held the majority of legislative seats. and they held the majority of local partisan elected offices in the United States. Now, they don't hold majorities in any of those areas. And I think one of the reasons is the Democratic Leadership Council has weakened, undermined, harmed the Democratic message to such an extent that a lot of people who traditionally would have voted easily, passionately, happily for the Democrats now feel that it's just not worth the effort.
Well, how big a presence do they have at the convention this year in Boston?
They're present, but they're not as present as they were, say, in 92, 96, 2000, because Kerry is not exactly in their camp. He is slightly more liberal on some issues, and so they're a little less influential, but they're here. They're dark knights, ride through the hall. But to be honest, they are not as influential this year as they were maybe 4 years ago or 8 years ago.
Any dissatisfaction that you take from the delegates and their comments to you about Kerry and his positions or issues with his problems with his cautiousness?
Yes, there's certainly frustration. I've talked to tons of delegates who would like him to be more passionate on the war, more critical of the Patriot Act, stronger on anti-corporate messages. Remember, most of the messages of the political left have really successfully connected with the grassroots Democrats. The Democratic Party's grassroots has moved left, not radically so, but, much more so than they were a few years ago. I'd be delighted to randomly nominate any delegate for president. You could just swoop down and pluck a delegate off the floor. He or she would probably be better on the issue.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his columns in the pages of The Nation or online at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.